Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. In welcoming you to today's occasional lecture, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the Canberra area, the Ngunnawal and the Ngambri people, and to pay respect to the elders, past and present, of all Australia's Indigenous peoples. This afternoon is sadly our last occasional lecture for the year, but I'm sure that you will thank yourselves for coming along today on a rainy Friday the 13th. It's a great pleasure to be able to introduce to you today Dr. Chris Sarah. He is the founder and chairman of Stronger Smarter Institute, but you may have seen him on a 2004 Australian Story when, as the then principal of the Cherbourg State School in southeast Queensland, he was reported on for his innovative approach to education, particularly Indigenous education, and the amazing results that he achieved in his tenure at Cherbourg School. He applied those principles and learnings and founded the Stronger, Smarter Institute to take those principles forward. And today it's a great pleasure to introduce him to speak to you about high expectations realities through high expectations relationships, delivering beyond the Indigenous policy rhetoric. Now, before he starts, can I remind you to please put your mobile phones to silent and sit back and enjoy our lecture. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and thank you for coming along on this rainy Friday, the 13th, Black Friday. I'm feeling like it's my day today, so. Welcome to all of those people who are watching online as well. Ladies and gentlemen, let me start this lecture as I should by also acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land upon which we meet. As part of my duty as an NRL commissioner, I had to be at the 2015 Telstra Premiership Grand Final. It was an epic match, wasn't it? And easily sits as one of the best grand finals ever. The Broncos defended their line fiercely and admirably for 79 minutes and 45 seconds. Then, just as even the most loyal of Cowboys fans, like me, had all virtually given up, Jonathan Thurston refuses to die with the ball as he searches for his magical halves partner, Michael Morgan. Morgan takes the ball with seconds remaining. Cowboys fans like me are saying, no, hang on, we might be a chance here. And with moments to go, Michael Morgan does what Thurston expects of him and conjures some magic to put Kyle Feld away in the corner to level the scores on the last second of the last minute, with the kick to come to win the game after the hooter. And as if the football gods had not messed with our heads enough, Thurston kicks. It looks like it's going in, and it hits the post, and now we have to go into extra time. The rest is history now, as the Cowboys capitalise on a Broncos error. Sorry, Broncos fans. In front of the post, and Jonathan Thurston goes on to kick the winning field goal. Cowboys fans like me start to cry, which I did, because we have waited for this moment for 20 years. There are so many things that are special about this day and this game. In the previous game, an Indigenous captain holds high the NRL State Championship trophy, holds it aloft. In the main game, two Indigenous captains, Justin Hodges and Jonathan Thurston, lead their teams in this epic grand final. This is the great thing about rugby league. The playing field is level. Indigenous players bring their sense of strength and excellence, which is acknowledged, embraced, and celebrated. At the end of the game, we see Thurston and Hodges embrace after the game, which was as fair as it was superb. Hodges is consoled by his lovely dad and his wife. Thurston sits on the ground with his gorgeous daughter, who holds that famous black baby doll. and gives her tired dad a hug and a kiss. Excellence and humanity at its best. Earlier in the day, I approached Malcolm Turnbull to congratulate him on his ascendancy to the Prime Minister, to the Prime Ministership. And as I described, his very clever appointment of Senator Arthur Sinodinos to the role of Cabinet Secretary. As I mentioned to him, at least now we can have something that resembles a functional cabinet, as opposed to the crippling, centralised way of governing that many of us had become so frustrated by. This whole Prime Minister for Indigenous Affairs thing, I told him, has done more harm than good and seems to be more about gimmicks, personalities and polls rather than proper policy process. The Minister for Indigenous Affairs must be trusted and able to get on with his role without distractions and confusion about who is responsible for what. He then said to me, "Chris, what are three things we can do in the Indigenous policy space to make a difference?" Now, it's too important and too complex a question to answer at an NRL grand final. And I did have to focus on the game. So I said to the Prime Minister, "I do have an answer for you, but I'll get back to you with those three things at some stage soon." To which he responded, "Please do." It occurred to me that the answer to Prime Minister Turnbull's question was being played out right before us on that epic grand final night. On a level playing field, we saw the humanity of Indigenous Australians authentically acknowledged, embraced with enthusiasm, and celebrated with passion. We saw young Indigenous Australians nurtured by hope, which cultivated their strengths and excellence and encouraged them to chase down their dreams, no matter how lofty they seemed. We saw Indigenous leadership working with non-Indigenous leadership together on and off the field in an elite and honourable, high expectations relationship. This is the perfect analogy for the Australian society we can develop. There are three things we can do. The first thing we can do is acknowledge and embrace and celebrate the humanity of Indigenous Australians. The second thing we can do, or the Prime Minister can do, is bring us policy approaches that nurture hope and optimism rather than entrench despair. And the third thing is do things with us, not to us. Acknowledging and embracing and celebrating the humanity of Indigenous Australians. It is always a complex and for many hurtful challenge to reflect on the past in such a way that we learn from the awful tragedies of our shared history without letting it define us in an unproductive way that can stifle our quest for shared emancipation into an honourable future. The truth is, there have been and continue to be many clear and graphic examples of where the humanity of Aboriginal Australians is either not embraced and acknowledged or simply undermined. It is also true that in some Aboriginal communities, we observe what might be described as subhuman behaviours. Now, at the risk of rendering some gross misbehaving and poor choice-making individuals inculpable of some despicable behaviours, I would argue quite strongly that when we treat individuals as though they are subhuman, then subhuman behaviours are likely to emerge. I have never backed down from calling out such injustices from both sides of this relationship. But on this occasion, let me reflect positively on the example I gave at the outset of this lecture with our two Indigenous NRL Grand Final captains. After the game, on that level playing field, embracing each other, then embracing their families. My simple point, as strange as this may sound, is this. Our humanity exists. Our humanity exists and it must be acknowledged. It is worth embracing and celebrating. Our humanity has existed for tens of thousands of years on this land we now share. And it continues to exist proudly, despite the efforts of post-colonial governments to smash us and smash us and smash us. This is not an invitation to smash us even more, but rather an opportunity for you to understand that such efforts are futile and that our humanity cannot ever be assimilated nor destroyed. Nor should you want to, because we share this ancient land. And as we share this ancient land, we share humanity. When you embrace and celebrate the humanity of Indigenous Australians, you embrace and celebrate your own humanity, because it is our humanity that we share at our core. To help us understand this more deeply, let me reflect on some of my earlier work inspired by my late friend and the very great modern-day philosopher, my dear friend, Professor Roy Bhaskar. Bhaskar discusses the concept of the concrete universal, which has four dimensions. At its base is the notion of a core universal human nature. We are all of the human race, and this should ensure unquestionable grounds for human rights. At a higher level, this basic core is acted upon or mediated through a variety of, as Roy would say, differentia, such as gender, sexuality, age, ethnicity, culture, etc. The core and the mediations result in a concretely singularized individual. The fourth dimension to this concept is that of processuality, or the rhythms of time in action. The key to understanding the importance of the concept of the concrete universal is that it is part of a stratified ontology, or stratified insight into our sense of being. Put simply, each of us has layers or stratifications of being. As well, the notion of processuality allows one to recognise that at differing times in the life of an individual, the mediations or the individuality upon the core humaneness can be of greater or less salience. If we can accept the terms of Bhaskar's insights here, then we have hope of being liberated from those toxic dynamics that are quintessential to the binary of mainstream and other, whereby mainstream is somehow superior. Put simply, all of us are set free from the pressure of being one or the other, as it becomes the case that we can be content with who we actually are, knowing that at some times we actually can have a strong resonance with a sense of being mainstream. And at other times, and in other contexts, we can have equally as strong resonance with a sense of being other. Let me explain. When I stand on my father's land, in the land of my father's people, at the village of Miglianico, in the province of Abruzzo, Italia, my sense of being Italian resonates strongly for me. When I stand before the graves of my father's parents, speaking Italian with my half-brother Giulio, my sense of being Italian continues to resonate strongly, and he embraces me as such. At my core, I am human, and the resonance of my Italian ethnic differentia is dramatically enhanced by processuality, which sees me on my father's country, Italia, in that moment in time. Now, significantly, my sense of being Aboriginal or my sense of being Australian is not relinquished here. It simply does not resonate so strongly. And when I'm at home on my country, in my hometown, Bundaberg, and I'm fishing in the Burnett River, knowing that my people have done this for thousands of years, my sense of being Aboriginal is very strong. In this place, in this point in time, I often look across the river to Paddy's Island, a place where many of my ancestors were massacred, and I wonder what life must have been like for them before, during and after the slaughter of so many. In that moment, at my core, I am human, and my sense of being Aboriginal resonates very strongly, enhanced by the sense of time and place that locates me there. I have not relinquished my sense of being Italian, nor my sense of being Australian. It's just not resonating as strongly in that time and that place. As I reflect on times when my sense of being Australian resonates more strongly, I think of rugby league, greatest game of all, of barbecues and the beach. In a deeper sense, I think of when my mum's house in Bundaberg was completely flooded by the devastating January 2013 floods, and a mud army of volunteers who I didn't even know turned up to help my family clean up and rebuild. At my core here, in that moment and at that time, I remain human. And this humanity is shared with those around me. My sense of being Australian resonates strongly here, given the time, place, and context. In such times, when tragedy strikes, we stick together as Australians and we just get in and help. It's what we do. In this circumstance, I have not surrendered my sense of being Italian, nor have I surrendered my sense of being Aboriginal. Understanding and embracing the notion of a stratified ontology not only liberates Aboriginal people from the toxic dynamics of being forced to be mainstream, it is indeed an intellectual concept that is emancipatory for white Australians. Many white Australians have experienced this also. I'm sure you have, perhaps unknowingly. Many have experienced a strong and very powerful sense of spirituality, if you like, when visiting the graves of your ancestors in England, Scotland, Ireland, or wherever. At your core, you remain human, while the differentia of that ancestral ethnicity, enhanced by the processuality of their time and place, are the very dynamics that kind of fill a hole in people, and they, as they sometimes describe. Importantly, they do not surrender their sense of being Australian, but their sense of humanity and an overall sense is enhanced. Acknowledging and embracing and celebrating our humanity means you would never let our communities continue to be neglected at the end of the vine, characterise our existence in remote parts of Australia as some form of flippant lifestyle choice. Acknowledging and embracing and celebrating our humanity means you would never amend the Racial Discrimination Act, especially to inflict policy approaches on us in a way that would never be inflicted upon other Australians. It means you would acknowledge us as the original custodians in our nation's constitution. Acknowledging, embracing, and celebrating our humanity means we could find the courage to contemplate a treaty, a document upon which we both agree, no matter how long or how complex this task is. Bring us policy approaches that nurture hope and optimism rather than entrench despair. Again, as we watch the NRL Grand Final won by the Cowboys, I think I mentioned that, we witnessed excellence manifested and born out of the seeds of hope sown many years later. You know, it's one of the things I love about being a NRL commissioner. I get to see very solid young men and women playing rugby league for their country at the elite level, just knowing that at some stage earlier in their lives, they dreamed of being a kangaroo or of being a Jillaroo. These dreams can only manifest when they are nurtured by hope. If politicians and other policymakers operate from a philosophical basis that acknowledges and embraces the humanity of Indigenous Australians, there is scope for policy approaches and programs to nurture hope and optimism rather than entrench despair. When it comes to constructively aligning people, philosophy, policy, and programs, we must understand that ultimately We are dealing with a relationship. The relationship is, of course, the one between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australia. Both parties have a responsibility to tend that relationship and ensure that it is healthy and a source of mutual benefit. My own research, triangulated by our shared instincts, show that the relationship is not as healthy as it should be. It empirically unveils a world of ambient racism and unhelpful yet persistent negative stereotyping of Aboriginal people. Persistent to the extent that non-Aboriginal and regrettably Aboriginal Australians subscribe to, as if it was some kind of truth, when in fact it was not. Too many of us are blasted by the single-barreled so-called reality, calling this inaccurate yet prolific reality into some form of being. Too many of us don't realise we actually have a choice, but then unwittingly we choose to collude with this toxic so-called reality, nurturing it to make it appear more real than it actually is. Sometimes non-Aboriginal people do this because it readily fits with the narrative of Aboriginal people as what I have described in other papers as a despised other. Sometimes non-Aboriginal people do this because they might inadvertently think they are being culturally sensitive when in fact they are simply colluding with a negative stereotype. Some Aboriginal people collude with this stereotype thinking they are reinforcing their cultural identity when in fact they are simply reinforcing a negative stereotype and or clinging to a sense of victim status that no longer serves us in a modern society. Sometimes Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people collude with and nurture this toxic negative stereotype because, bluntly, there is lots of money and power in keeping this industry alive as we entrench the despair of Aboriginal people pretending to do otherwise. These dynamics of stereotyping and collusion are what Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman calls fast thinking. This fast thinking consists of slurs, insults, names, sayings, jokes, opinions, metaphors, metonyms, and slogans. There's no need for me to rehearse with you the world of fast thinking about Indigenous Australia. The problem is that fast thinking is almost immune to logic and the reality of what Kahneman calls slow thinking. People still believe that Aboriginal Australians have lots of privileges, despite all the rational and statistical evidence to the contrary. The language of fast thinking is a house of being, and it determines how we think and how we act. This is why fast thinking is influenced not by rational, slow thinking, but by alternative fast thinking. Now, it seems clear that our current Prime Minister knows this. During the Rudd-Abbott years, we were spooked and then paralysed by incessant bleeding or fast thinking about some budget crisis. Today, after being offered alternative fast thinking and told that this is a time for hope and optimism and that there has never been a more exciting time to be Australian, we find ourselves as a nation tentatively embracing a more authentic dialogue on tax reform. In fast thinking on Indigenous affairs, we often hear things like, we've tried everything and nothing has worked, when actually we haven't tried everything, and we certainly haven't seriously tried a high expectations relationship policy approach. We say things like, we've spent billions in Aboriginal communities, when most of the dollars are more likely spent on bureaucracies and consultants before it even gets to communities. We have a catchy mantra of closing the gap, which in many ways suggests that we as blackfellas are here and other Australians are there, with a big gap in the middle that leaves us blackfellas with some catching up to do if we are to be as good as the average white Australian. When in fact the truth is better reflected in the less catchy notion of shifting the bell curve to the right, a notion that reminds us that many Aboriginal people are as exceptional as our fellow Australians. My simple point here is that fast thinking, or policy rhetoric if you like, often does more to entrench a sense of hopelessness and despair rather than nurture a sense of hope and optimism. Even big spending on so-called well-intentioned silk purse policy approaches fail dismally on this measure and ultimately are and will be exposed as the filthy pig's ear that they are. In my memoir, Good Morning, Mr. Sara, published in 2012 by UQ Press, I recalled as an educator, I recalled an encounter with a proud yet almost deflated Aboriginal man in Alice Springs at the time of the juggernaut that was the Northern Territory intervention. In our encounter, the young man said to me with a deep sense of hurt in his voice, he said, Chris, you don't know how hard it is to be an Aboriginal man in this town. You walk down the street here and these people just look at you like you're some kind of pedophile or like you've just come from bashing your woman at home. It is impossible to argue that such an approach, which saw signs erected to brand Aboriginal communities as they did, while sending the army in from the outside to fix them, could instill a sense of hope and optimism. Now, I'm not denying for a moment that toxic and subhuman behaviours exist in some Aboriginal communities and must be flushed out. And you will argue that toxic and subhuman behaviours exist, and I will agree with you. I will then challenge you, though, to wonder about why such behaviours exist and remind you, again, that when you treat people as though they are subhuman, then subhuman behaviours emerge. And what I find grossly offensive is this dynamic in which we hone in on extremely toxic and subhuman behaviours and conflate their existence as if all Aboriginal people are behaving in such ways. Roy Baskar would call this the epistemic fallacy. Briefly, this is the reduction of being or reality to our knowledge of it. Or if you like, the refusal to make a distinction between ontology and epistemology. Another way of explaining this is that makers of Indigenous policy, including government-appointed so-called Indigenous leaders, do not understand the fundamental importance of a strength-based approach to community and individual transformation. Even those who enjoy choreographed visits to Aboriginal communities cannot fully understand the depth of complexity required to be useful, especially if they listen and observe simply to confirm their own way of thinking, rather than listening and observing for authentic understanding. And whilst they may be great at spending taxpayers' money conjuring expensive yet ineffective government programs and quasi-bureaucracies, their unsophisticated, deficit-based elucidations expose them as impotent amidst the profound need for stratified, strength-based approaches to individual and community transformation. It also renders them completely ignorant amidst the profound need for deep and compassionate understanding of the stratified ontology of Aboriginal people and our communities. When I worked as principal at Sherbrooke School for 6.5 years, we fixed attendance with a sophisticated and stratified strength-based approach. 38% of children were not attending school. We didn't immediately resort to cut welfare payments. In fact, we didn't do that at all. We didn't resort to cutting payments as if 100% of children were disengaged. With a strength-based approach, we recognised that 62% actually were engaged. And if we celebrated and reinforced this great strength, both extrinsically and intrinsically, then we were likely to positively influence most of, perhaps not all, of the remaining 38%. And by acknowledging and celebrating the strengths on display, attendance went from 62% to 94%. The remaining 6% had more hardcore needs, And we also pursued this as best as we could, but in a more low-key way. It was an approach simple to understand, yet hard work to execute, but one that was effective and cost less than 1% of the taxpayers' money we see spent in some schools today in deficit approaches that assume all students and all Aboriginal parents are chronically disengaged. I was in Warburton in remote West Australia as recently as last week. The week before that, I was in Wiluna, and the week before that in Bladderwich in the Northern Territory. And the conversations there remind me that such frustrations and such despair persists with policy and program approaches that simply conflate single-barreled understandings about Aboriginal people and communities and offer ineffective, unsophisticated blanket approaches that simply don't make sense. Not only do they not make sense, they are causing an even greater sense of despair and disengagement from Australian society. This is an aspect of the stratified ontology of Aboriginal people that your makers of Indigenous policy simply do not understand. As blackfellas, we think you can bring on your policies and programs and bash us and bash us and bash us. We will not change. We will not become the people you want us to be. We will submit in some way, but in a way that will see us become passive, simply disengage or readjust because we are so accustomed to you smashing us and our communities. And I'm sure some of you may have seen this passivity and disengagement without even knowing that you've seen it. Some of you have been tricked into believing that such passivity is the result of welfare, when in fact, it is the result of chronic disengagement from a local and vibrant economy. Welfare and a basic social security structure did not cause chronic disengagement from the economy. A lack of desire to pay equal wages to Aboriginal people in the late 1960s caused chronic disengagement from the economy. We moved from a time when Aboriginal people were actively engaged, and proudly so, to a time when we became disengaged. A lack of desire to invest substantially into innovative, vibrant and sophisticated localised economies entrenches ongoing chronic disengagement. But you've never been seriously challenged to understand the deep complexities here. You've never been challenged because in order to seduce you, it's better to pretend that you are not culpable in any way for the challenges we face together. If I can make it seem like Aboriginal people are entirely to blame here, you'll describe me as a hero and you'll throw millions at me and never seriously question the efficacy of my approaches, even if they take us back to policy approaches of the last century. You've never been challenged because, frankly, there is great power and money to be had from the entrenched despair of Aboriginal people. Personally, I think this reluctance to challenge underestimates your intelligence and your humanity, leaving us all floundering with a limited hope of transcending the challenges that we face together. Today I challenge the Prime Minister, not to pick a fight with him, but because I respect his interest in a positive future for all of us. I respect his intellectual and emotional capacity to embrace and be honest about the extent to which he is culpable in a high expectations relationship with Aboriginal Australia, and I'm committed to the same. And you, Prime Minister, and your policymakers have a choice. You can choose the more expensive and ineffective option of continuing to devise policy approaches that continue to demonise us and entrench despair. You can bring policy approaches to bash us and bash us and bash us. Or you can bring us policy approaches that offer hope and a sense of pride and a feeling that we can trust and walk with you into what I would call a stronger, smarter, more honourable future where your emancipation is bound up in mine. Do things with us, not to us. When Cowboys coach Paul Green set about conjuring a way to win the NRL Grand Final, I think I mentioned that, didn't I? He collaborated seriously with his Indigenous captain, Jonathan Thurston. He did this because Thurston has wisdom and sophisticated insights to offer. He did this because he had an authentic belief in the strengths and knowledge that were obvious, and sometimes not so obvious, in his team's captain. A key pillar of the Stronger, Smarter approach is high expectations relationships as opposed to high expectations rhetoric. Sometimes high expectations rhetoric espouses lofty ideals that are often imposed with intentions from the outside rather than negotiated with individuals or communities to be affected. I mentioned earlier the fundamental importance of understanding that as we contemplate the challenges we face together, we are in a relationship in which we must ensure that it is healthy and a source of mutual benefit. For me, I think my greatest intellectual insight over the last 2 years is understanding the profound difference between high expectations of Aboriginal people versus the notion of high expectations with Aboriginal people. High expectations rhetoric versus a high expectations relationship. I can assure you that we as Aboriginal people want to be on the journey with you. This journey, however, must be one that enables us to be the best that we want to be, not a journey in which we are forced to be who you want us to be. Let me assure you that as Aboriginal people, we have an interest, a very strong interest, in being the exceptional people that we are and can be. None of us aspire to be downtrodden, uneducated, disempowered, and dysfunctional. None of us. It is often the case that sometimes well-intentioned non-Indigenous Australians make fatal mistakes at the very genesis of their relationship with Aboriginal Australians. Imagine you and me preparing for an important journey together, standing alongside each other, and calibrating our compasses for what I would call a stronger, smarter destination. Even just to stand together, we must have purged from our relationship the toxic stench of low expectations, mistrust, and stifled perceptions of each other. From this point, we have a chance of getting our compasses aligned and going somewhere special. If you stand alongside me, though, well-intentioned, but in this relationship, feeling sorry for me, as if I have to be rescued, the relationship is contaminated from the start, leaving us a few degrees out from each other and destined to become parted in the long run. You might come to the relationship assuming that I must change my ways and become like you in every way, emulating your way of existing, assimilated if you like. In this circumstance, you assume that you are superior to me and I am inferior to you. With this as our starting point, the relationship is again contaminated and we calibrate our compass in a way that gives us no chance of taking an honourable journey together. In some ways, this analogy, this compass analogy, explains why we spend billions on Aboriginal affairs and achieve no appreciable gains. If, however, we start the relationship in which our strengths and our humanity are acknowledged and embraced, and we are convinced of an authentic sense of hope for all, then our hearts can truly beat closely together, and our compasses can be calibrated for an exciting, sometimes bumpy, yet honourable journey into the future. In a practical sense, this means identifying and embracing local community leadership that is proven, rather than anointing Aboriginal leadership that will only tell you what you want to hear. On the Aboriginal education landscape, if we have the courage, it means acknowledging that Aboriginal parents do want the best for their children, and being bold enough in a policy sense to offer those parents who work in partnership with schools to get their children to school for more than 85% of the school year, the guarantee that their child will achieve at the national minimum standard on all years 3, 5, 7, and 9 benchmarks. Beyond year nine, if we are bold enough, it means offering a guaranteed service outcome in the form of a job, a place in training, or a place in a university to all Indigenous students who complete year 12 with better than 85% school attendance. This is doing things with people, not to people. It means doing whatever it takes to inject exceptional school leadership into remote Aboriginal communities. This is honouring and embracing humanity. This is offering hope. This is doing things with people, not to them. In some ways, the three things I've articulated here can, in essence, be seen as a triple bottom line for Indigenous policy analysis. My critics may well want to accuse me of being overly philosophical, but after 7 years as a very successful educator on the Indigenous education landscape and the education landscape more generally, I have nothing to prove. As an educator, I said I wanted to change expectations of Aboriginal children right across Australia, and today expectations have changed. Today, there is no place to hide for any teacher with low expectations in any classroom in Australia. Of course, there are people still out there, but it is only a matter of time before they are exposed and challenged. And whilst these three points might seem philosophical to some, the truth is that this is the very approach and way of thinking that enabled me to work with staff, students and the community at Cherbourg some years ago to deliver transformational change. The formula for success here was very simple, but as is always the case, the work was very hard. There are no silver bullets or quick fixes here, and it will not be fixed by a product that we buy off the shelf in America that is simply a remedial product. Notwithstanding, the formula was simple. It was so simple that we have proven it is able to be extrapolated by those who are prepared to work extremely hard and apply the stronger, smarter, high expectations relationships approach, which acknowledges, honours and embraces a positive sense of Aboriginal identity and works with positive Aboriginal leadership that is beyond victim status. Beyond Cherbourg, the Stronger Smarter Institute has for the last 10 years worked with more than 500 schools and communities and more than 2,000 education and community leaders with an exponential reach of more than 38,000 Indigenous Australian students. That's more than you'll affect with a scholarship to an elite private school. In North Queensland at Yarrabah State School, 83% of year three students at national minimum standards for reading, 56 Indigenous youth, 10% of the student population re-engaged with school. The percentage of parents who think the school is providing a good education for their children increased from 60% in 2009 to 96% in 2014. Aitkenvale State School in Townsville reduced student suspensions by 70% within one term. At Pomperow State School in Cape York, Year 5 students have the highest reading results within their group of similar schools in 2000 and 2014. And this continues to improve and outperform nearby Cape York schools that are seeing millions of dollars invested into them. At that same school, 44% increase in students at or above the national minimum standards on NAPLAN spelling results for the same cohort from 2009 to 2013. In the Kimberley region, Wyndham District High School, a 16% improvement in school attendance over a three-year period, 25% improvement in year three reading to be above national benchmarks within a year. At Broome Senior High School, 100% retention of Aboriginal students through year 8 to year 12 from a base of zero. From 0% to 100% retention. At Fitzroy District High School, suspensions for poor behaviour were reduced by 74% within 2 years. At Daywell Remote Community School in the Kimberley, they see up to 100% attendance at parent engagement activities. At Kalumbaroo, there was a 700% increase in the number of Aboriginal people actively employed at the school within 3 years. Mount Margaret Remote Aboriginal School saw 94% attendance and a 37.5% improvement in reading levels over a two-year period. In northern Victoria, Swan Hill Primary School has introduced a local Indigenous language program for year one. They've also seen a 10% increase in Koori student attendance since 2010. Mildura Primary School has closed the gap on NAPLAN results. They've closed the gap. And 84% of year five students are achieving national minimum standards, the highest within the region. At New South Wales, Glenroy Heights Public School, they saw attendance jump to 94%, up from 77% just 4 years earlier. They also saw a dramatic reduction in Aboriginal student suspensions from 274 learning days lost in 2007 down to just 13 days in 2011. Above and beyond these significant returns for Aboriginal children, I'm more than delighted to say that the stronger, smarter approach and high expectations relationships delivers much needed positive change for poor white children as well, who in many ways are just as infected by this toxic stench of low expectations. In closing, I'd love to talk to you more about rugby league, the greatest game of all. But instead, let me conclude on a more sombre and profound note. While Jonathan Thurston and Justin Hodges, two of the great sons of Australian Rugby League, rose to the challenge and delivered excellence on a level playing field, a field where others worked with them to nurture a sense of hope, where their excellence was acknowledged and embraced and celebrated, it is the great Ujuru Noonuccal in a message to her son who offers us all as a nation an even greater challenge. My son, your troubled eyes search mine. Puzzled and hurt by colour line. Your black skin as soft as velvet shine. What can I tell you, son of mine? I could tell you of heartbreak, hatred blind. I could tell you of crimes that shame mankind. Of brutal wrong and deeds malign. Of rape and murder, son of mine. But I'll tell you instead of brave and fine, when lives of black and white entwine and men in brotherhood combine, this I would tell you, son of mine. I suspect that Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull is right when he says that there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian and that this is a time for hope. Let us share in this sense of hope in three profoundly simple ways. Acknowledge, embrace, and celebrate the humanity of Aboriginal Australians. Bring us policy approaches that nurture hope and optimism rather than entrench despair. Do things with us, not to us. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chris. That was wonderful. You've earned a rest.
All right.
I'll explain the microphone arrangements. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment about that wonderful presentation, we do have a couple of microphones at the side of the room, and you don't have to get up and go to them. We'll send them to you if you put your hand up. Yes, up the back.
Thank you very much. I think you've reminded us how important sport can be as a factor in society. And I'm from Victoria, so I don't know much about rugby, sorry. But I'd be really interested to hear a bit more about what you're doing to empower women to compete professionally, to play, and also potentially any initiatives you're doing to support the prevention of violence against women and their children. Thank you.
Just a small issue.
Yeah. Look, let me answer your question in two parts because it's a very important question. As a rugby league commissioner, we take very seriously the need to stamp out domestic violence so that it's not a part of our game. We understand very well the potential for our high-profile players to be able to say to people who follow them all around in communities in every corner of Australia, this is not acceptable. And so we do what we can in that space to make use of the profile and the sense of connectedness to our elite players. You'll also see quite a dramatic shift in the profile of women in the game of rugby league. And so that's been increased dramatically under the NRL brand through greater participation through a partnership with Touch Football Australia. But it's also been improved, and I'm really pleased to watch this, the elevation of the profile of the Gillaroos and the Queensland and New South Wales women's rugby league teams. So that's that part. From an educator's perspective, we used to contemplate this question at when I was at Sherbrooke School. We talked to kids about being strong and being smart. And I did talk with them about what that actually meant. And it meant strong enough to understand that when we encounter conflict, that there are other ways to deal with those issues, and that it means internally we have to be strong rather than use our fists or think that we have to inflict pain, physical pain on people. Look, it's a really complex question, and in part I hope that answers it.
Thank you. Chris, can I ask the next question? I mean, those were astonishing results that you were reading out to us at the end. Now, you yourself as principal of Sherbrooke were there implementing these approaches to education. But when you work with schools and the schools you mentioned, how do you actually get into the schools and work with them? Do you train teachers, or do you have staff or associates who can go and work in the school? How does it work?
It's important to understand that all of the results, they're really fantastic, and I really love the fact that we've been a part of that journey. But I've been in schools myself, and I know how hard it is to achieve those sorts of outcomes. And so I acknowledge all of those school and community leaders who are the true heroes in delivering those outcomes. From our perspective, we work with school and community leaders to get them to understand what we call the stronger, smarter approach and the things that underpinned kind of the success at Sherbrooke. And so it's not really about saying to them, we did this at Sherbrooke, so you need to do this in your community. It's about getting them to understand the overarching philosophical kind of concept and understanding the importance of simple things, like when you break it down in a micro sense, engaging children and having conversations with teachers and analysing the kind of intellectual sort of integrity of our classrooms and asking questions like, is this classroom environment, is this teacher performing, or is the essence of that teacher-student relationship, is that the kind that I would accept for my own child? And if the answer is no, then we shouldn't be asking anybody else to accept it. To understand that is very, very simple, but to execute a response to that is very, very hard work.
Yes, up the back.
Is this working?
I can hear you.
Okay, great. About 12 years ago, some premiers commissioned a report by Fitzgerald to look at the examination of the GST and the horizontal fiscal equalisation. And what happens is that state governments come in and bid for money, put in bids to the Grants Commission saying they need to provide services, particularly to Aboriginal communities, and they will get extra money in the carve-up because it's a lot more expensive to provide those services, but then they don't provide them. It seems, and it's been going on for 20, 30 years. This was one of the key findings that Fitzgerald made in his report, and then the premiers put the report in the drawer and didn't really want to talk about it. But how do you feel? Do you feel that when you see state governments competing for extra funding to provide services and then not provide them, that we're dropping the ball completely as a nation?
I think it's pretty easy to imagine how I would feel about that circumstance. And I think in many ways, I would go back to the conversation with the Prime Minister about the need to just execute excellent policy and programs approaches. And that's all we're asking for. And so these dynamics and these circumstances that you describe exist. But they only exist, I think, in a way that... if you go to my original point that the humanity of people, of Aboriginal people, is not acknowledged. And so what enables that kind of behaviour from bureaucrats and politicians is this sense that, oh, well, it's only black kids in remote communities, so what the hey, you know. If a policeman causes the death of an Aboriginal man, it's only an Aboriginal man, you know. Look, it's only a remedial product. It might be costing several tens of millions of dollars. It's off the shelf from the US, and it can only ever deliver remedial outcomes, even when it's executed superbly. It's only black kids, so what the hell? As long as we look like we're making big policy announcements, that's all we care about. And that those ways of behaving undermine or signal to me that there is a lack of acknowledgement of the humanity that we bring to the country. And so when we're perceived in this way, those sorts of behaviours are manifested. And so if we can do the three things that we talked about, one would hope that those behaviours are flushed out.
Yes, down here, Tim.
That was very informative.
Thank you.
Would you care to comment on the role of homeland centres, in particularly with this latest development in Western Australia?
Yeah, look, I think it's worth understanding the richness of what Aboriginal Australia brings to the nation. My very strong belief is that there's good reason for all of us to celebrate the fact that we have Aboriginal people living in homeland centres. And it's worth paying for that, because when we do that, we play our part as a society in retaining a connection, a human connection to the land that has existed for tens of thousands of years. In some circles, it's thought about as the oldest form of human existence on the planet. And so why the hell would we undermine that circumstance? Why would we want to be seen as a nation that housed the longest human connection to country and then set about through policy approaches that try to force them into provincial centres and cut that connection off after it's existed for tens of thousands of years? To me, it doesn't make sense. It represents a lack of appreciation of the humanity of Aboriginal people in those places, and it represents a lack of insight into the value that we bring to the country. When Desmond Tutu was asked about what black South Africans bring to Africa, he said, we bring the Ubuntu. Now, in some ways, it's kind of like the spunk or the thing that enchants our nation, and that's what having Aboriginal people in this country connected to country in the way that we've been done. That's what we bring to the country, and that should never be underestimated.
Okay, time for one more down the front. Oh, two more if it's short.
Thanks. Go ahead. Thanks, Chris. That was motivational and challenging as always. You've issued some really important challenges to the Prime Minister, and you've mentioned bureaucrats as the deliverers of the politicians' commitments. There's obviously a large bureaucracy out there, both state and federal and local government. Can you just perhaps expand a little bit more on what are the skills, knowledge and attitudes that you think we need to be seeing from bureaucrats in order to inject that humanity and that the senses that you've been enunciating so well here today?
I think, Stephen, it comes down to that very micro kind of insight. And that is, would we accept this way of behaving for non-Aboriginal Australians? Now, we see some crazy things that happen in the Indigenous policy space, and I'm sure they happen in other policy spaces as well. But all we ask for, all I'm asking for, is deliver kind of policy rhetoric and policy programs that are considered excellent and logical policy processes. You see, it doesn't make sense that Pomperow School that I mentioned earlier is achieving excellent outcomes, outperforming a school up the road where they've been kind of forced into having to endure a product that's bought off the shelf. Now, Pomperow School is outperforming that school after the other school has had $8 million poured into it to execute this remedial direct instruction approach that's if you read the papers, you would assume that it's fantastic, but the actual data is saying that it's not working. So they pour $8 million into that. Now, policy logic would say this school is outperforming that school. There's $8 million going into that school. Maybe we should have a closer look at what's happening here. But what actually did happen 3 weeks before, I think, I need to check my facts on this, but I think 3 weeks before the NAPLAN results were due to come out, the Federal Minister for Education announces a $22 million rollout of this program here. Now, in a policy logic sense, that just doesn't make sense. Policy logic would say, why don't we have a look at what the data is saying? And that's all I'm saying. So just good policy execution.
Finally, up the back. Thank you.
Last one, just kind of bringing together a number of different things that you've talked about today, I wondered if you could speak to the ideas of humanity and celebrating Aboriginality while not perpetuating a victim mentality, but also in the educational realm, what does that look like when we implement programs and resourcing specifically for Aboriginal students? I wondered if you could, kind of speak to that.
Yeah, thank you for your question. I think it's best encapsulated in the sort of approach that we took. I don't like to talk ourselves up too much, but I reflect on the children at Sherberg School and, the elders at Sherberg and the parents at Sherberg Community. And I just look at the way that when I challenge those kids to stand up and to be strong and proud to be Aboriginal and to be work hard so that we could be smart enough to mix it, they rose to the challenge because they saw value in being both strong and smart. And it wasn't about getting black kids and trying to turn them into being like white kids. It was about not flipping stuff in, but it was about getting the strength that existed in them and drawing that out. Now, it's a wonderful thing to reflect on that because effectively that is the place where the ripple started, which ultimately created a tide that would change expectations of Aboriginal children right across Australia. And I think of those kids, and I'm really proud of their efforts to stand up and embrace the challenge. But that's what it's about. It's about being strong and being smart.
And I think that's a perfect note to end on. I'd like you to join me in thanking Chris for a wonderful lecture. Take the challenge and the inspiration with you. Thank you.
I did mention the Cowboys, right?
Yeah. Oh, and the Cowboys apparently won some football match.